It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The city of Milwaukee recorded its 100th homicide of the year on Monday.
The victim was 17-year-old Javonte Davis of Milwaukee, who police say was inside a vehicle where occupants had been engaged in gunfire.
The overall number and rate of homicides in Milwaukee has trended down over the last few years, but this recent tragedy highlights another concerning trend in the city.
According to the police department, more young people are involved as the victims and suspects in crimes. And local leaders are calling on families, neighbors, and organizations to step in and reach children and teens before they're involved in these acts.
Jeffrey Norman is the chief of police for the Milwaukee Police Department. Last month, he put out a letter to the community asking for help with intervening in the lives of Milwaukee youth. Chief Norman, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me here.
How is the city of Milwaukee doing this year compared to previous years when we look at homicides and violent crime?
So from a technical look at the statistics, mm-hmm. we're doing well. We're trending in the right direction, as we talked about in regards to, yes, we did record our 100th homicide a couple days ago. But compared to last year, it took a little bit longer to get to that point. And compared to where we're at last year, we are 28 homicides under or double digits in regards to our homicides. And that also trends with the violent crime. We're double digits under. But it still opens the conversation that one homicide is one too many, one shooting is one too many, which is why, as you referred to earlier, the call to action to remind our community, we all have a responsibility to get involved in impacting public safety.
We saw the numbers peak in 2022 going up, starting in the COVID year of 2020. Do we know why they went up then and why those numbers have gone down since 2022?
So this is a lot of anecdotal. Mm-hmm. I know that we're still trying to do a post-mortem of looking at what happened with 2020. But I do see that there was a lot of mental health issues, a lot of anxiety, poor conflict resolution. And when you combine that with the accessibility of weapons such as firearms, it's a bad mixture. And so with some of the things that we had back then, the stay-at-home orders, I mean, we're social people. We need to be around each other. Those things, I believe, aggravated situations where individuals use extreme measures to resolve issues. And we're really seeing our community leaning in. The Milwaukee Police Department is working with so many different partners and understanding that it is a collaborative effort that's going to get us out of this particular issue. And there's been a lot of great working with a lot of organizations that have helped us get these trends going the right direction.
You've said and written recently that the thing that's keeping you awake lately is a concern about younger people showing up as victims in some cases, as perpetrators in others of violent crime. What kind of things are you seeing that have you worried?
Well, one of the things that really gets me worried is that these young ones have their hands on firearms. And I always say this, they're not going to your local store to buy these. They don't have the ability to purchase these. These are situations where we as adults can really lean in and find ways to make sure that these particular firearms are not in the hands of youth. We're leaving firearms unattended in vehicles. We're leaving firearms unattended in our homes. Whether it's negligent or intentional, it's unacceptable. And when we see individuals such as our young ones, using this for their own means in regards to their, resolution of their conflict out there, it's really disturbing, or to in furtherance of crimes. And so these particular conversations can never be too many. We need to make sure that we're leaning into the communication. And for us as a police department, when we understand the intelligence that we're seeing, we will share. Under this administration, we're very, very communicative with our community. And again, as you saw with that particular letter to our community, that call to action of, we do need help.
Who are the people who need to be at the table? Who do you want to see stepping up to reach out to these kids to say, hey, to prevent them getting involved in violence, whether it involves firearms or not?
Anyone who has a heartbeat. there's so many different opportunities, whether you're in the business community, whether you're in the education community, whether you are in the media. I mean, this is a platform to have these discussions. There is so many opportunities to support our community-based organizations. I know our elected leaders are leaning into this. And so I see this as an opportunity where it's reading a book to a young one, whether it's mentoring, whether it's funding some of our, community-based organizations. We do have a lot of great organizations within our city. Safe and Sound is one. The Boys and Girls Club of Greater Milwaukee. So there's a lot of great organizations out there who need your support. So there is no bystander. There's no wallflowers when it comes to this particular type of work. I don't say that you have to put on a badge and carry a firearm, even though I would love you to join the Milwaukee Police Department. We're hiring. But there is an opportunity, a platform for all of us to get involved.
When we're seeing that 13 or 14-year-old committing a crime using a firearm, obviously we've failed at that point, right? What do you see as a key point of intervention when that kid is in crisis, when they're on the verge of that? How do we get there and stop that from happening?
So one of the things that I say, especially when we talk about parents and guardians, you see your children best. And there are resources out there, whether it's through some of our social agencies, whether it's within our schools. The first step is reaching out to intervene before it becomes too far gone. The second is that, again, when we are seeing 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds in possession of firearms where you have to be 21 years of age to have a handgun, that is unacceptable. So we need to understand, are we contributing to the problem? There's no reason for these particular weapons to be accessible freely or in a way, like I said, negligently, where we've seen individuals such as young ones involved in these particular behaviors getting a hold of these particular weapons. So there is, again, that leaning in at the forefront with parents and guardians, reaching out to these resources in our community, because there's a lot of people who are willing to step in. But also as community members, especially those who are, using their right to carry firearms, just be responsible with it, please.
Talking to Jeffrey Norman, Chief of Police from the Milwaukee Police Department, looking at violent crime and homicide and his call for the whole community to get involved in intervening to help Milwaukee's youth. Chief Norman, what do we know about the pipeline that puts these firearms in the hands of people who, as you said, are too young to legally have them? How are those guns getting to them?
So some of the anecdotal stories I have, again, this is not anything of a, study, but, I see that there's individuals who go to work, leave their firearms in their vehicles. Those who are, attending, different type of events, leaving their firearms in vehicles. There's individuals who will possess firearms in their homes, leaving it unattended on tables. That's unacceptable. There's safes, there's locks. We have a lot of organizations that are possessing tools to be able to secure your firearms. There is a fortunate intelligence within the youth community. I mean, the kids been stealing cars as long as I've been alive on this earth. So that's not anything different, nor am I saying that's acceptable. But what is the difference is that there is this accessibility of unattended or unsecured firearms that are, again, being caught into the hands of these kids who are breaking into these cars. We do a great job of intervening. We are arresting those who are, breaking in and, unfortunately in those behaviors, but there's still a lot of capacity that we can as a community lean into by being more responsible. Gun safes for your vehicles, gun locks. I mean, there's a lot of things that we can do to, again, interrupt or disrupt that pipeline we talk about.
Something I've been curious about, seeing reports in other cities where major shootings involve Glock handguns that have been modified with a so-called switch that turns them effectively into automatic fire weapons. I know there's been an increase in automatic weapon prosecutions in Milwaukee County. Is this something you're seeing as a problem, maybe a growing problem?
Absolutely. I saw this years back as a district commander, and it continues to be a problem, especially when you talk about the 3D printing. There's a number of different ways to get a hold of these Glock switches. But best believe we are leaning into it as an agency. We will hold those accountable who are not only using them, but producing them. We have great partnerships with the federal government, our ATF partners. This is unacceptable, but it also makes it even these situations of gun usage even more problematic. Where back in the day, you might have one individual being shot. Now we have numerous individuals being shot because of these, modified handguns, where it is absolutely extremely dangerous, and that we are making sure that we are doing everything we can from just, again, public communication, but, very aggressive investigation and also aggressive prosecution of these.
Chief Norman, over the years, I've talked to a lot of people doing great work in Milwaukee when it comes to youth outreach, violence prevention, social services, and more. A thing I've heard again and again over the years is, yeah, there's a lot of us doing great work. We're not combining our efforts. We're not talking to each other. It's not coordinated. We're all doing our little, you know, one piece of the puzzle here. As you write this letter, do you see efforts to bring people together and make this a united front?
I say this much. I am so thankful to our community for the response, whether it's our elected officials, our community-based organizations, our residents. There is so much engagement on this topic. Now, we do have a lot of different engagements with a lot of our community-based organizations. We have called what's the VR Fast Violence Response through public health and safety teams. We have what we have is a weekly public safety review with a lot of our partners. So we do have the collaborations. Are we where we need to be at? No, but we are better than what we used to be at. And I know, especially from the Milwaukee Police Department, we are key to being that coordinator in regards to these type of efforts and continue to bring in more who are willing to contribute to this effort. And we're seeing great gains, as you can see, in regards to our numbers.
One other point I've seen you make recently, Chief Norman, we're talking about violence in Milwaukee, an important issue. You want to also send the message, though, Milwaukee is not a dangerous, violent place to visitors. People around the state might be surprised to hear that in our last minute. Make that case.
We are a wonderful city. I think we saw so many different great things that's going on, whether you talk about the Republican National Convention, where you talk about a number of different events. We have the great Summerfest. We have great venues. I love our city. Those who come to our city are pleasantly surprised. We are safe amongst the, you know, major cities out here. Come and see it for yourself. We have a great culture scene, art, you know, theater, food. This is a place to be.
Chief Norman, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Take care.
That's Jeffrey Norman, Chief of Police for the Milwaukee Police Department. He was with us today to share his concerns about a rising number of youth involved in crime and his department's efforts to reduce gun violence and to bring community members around the city on board to help tackle the problem.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a protective foam shell fits over football helmets to reduce head injuries. Guardian caps are approved in NFL games.
Contact sports have never been safer than they are now, certainly relative to when we played 40 years ago.
The latest on protective headgear on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the Packers host the Minnesota Vikings on Sunday, you might notice some players around the NFL wearing additional padding they put over their helmets.
They're called guardian caps, and NFL players are now allowed to wear them during games this season. The goal is to reduce head injuries.
We learn about the latest developments in reducing the risk of concussions and other head injuries during play with Mike McCray, a neurosurgery and neurology professor at Medical College of Wisconsin and director of its brain injury research program. McCray has served on the NFL's Head, Neck, and Spine Committee. Mike, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
It's a pleasure to be with you today. Thanks for having me.
Some football players are choosing to wear these large, soft-shelled pads over their football helmets, and the NFL has authorized the use of what are called guardian caps. Can you talk about what they are?
Yeah, so as you've alluded to, this is a soft outer shell that attaches to the exterior of a football helmet. This device and piece of equipment has been out in circulation for, I would say, somewhere in the order of about 5 years. You're now seeing it for the first time in regular season football games at the NFL level. But if you're a If you're a football parent, it's very likely that your high school or middle schooler has possibly been wearing a Guardian cap for the last several years at the local level. And while most of the attention in this space is focused on concussion prevention, and there have been numerous policy and rule changes, as well as clinical practice changes to prevent concussion, the other side of the coin is really about reducing repetitive head impact exposure. Lower magnitude blows to the head that don't cause concussive brain injury, but nonetheless are a target for prevention to help promote the health and safety of, in this case, football players, but really all contact sport athletes.
You referenced that new this season, the NFL allowing players to wear Guardian caps during games. Have you observed anything about their uptake? Are players wearing them?
Yeah, certainly you're seeing, I think, some traction amongst roster players currently in 2024. I suspect this will be like most things in sport and in prevention, that it'll start slowly and gain progress over time. Not to mention our young athletes at the youth and high school and collegiate level, seeing professional players wear the Guardian cap may make them more inclined to adopt the same.
That's so interesting you say that, because on the reverse side, are there any stigmas with this extra protective padding, like as in the athlete might not look and feel as tough when wearing it?
You know, my experience in working with professional athletes is that that has really done a 180 in the last 20 years. So, for instance, when I first started in concussion research and clinical care more than 30 years ago, athletes were very resistant to discussion around head injury. They avoided us like the plague for clinical evaluation if they were suspected of a concussion during practice or games. But more often than not, it's the athlete now, him or herself, who's coming forward, reporting symptoms, requesting evaluation, and seeking out information on their health and safety and prevention strategies. So that certainly would have been in play when I got started in this work three decades ago, but we now have an era and a generation of informed athletes who I say have grown up in the concussion age. 30 years ago, you know, this was not even recognized as an injury, and the best we had available to us was holding up two fingers and asking, you know, where are we and how many fingers on the sideline. And now we have advanced protocols that are informed by science, and really the ultimate benefactor of that work has been athletes themselves as we've improved the health and safety of sport.
I want to turn our attention to the degenerative brain disease known as chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. There is this new research in the medical journal JAMA Neurology surveying former professional football players, finding one-third think they have CTE. How widespread might it be?
Yeah, so the main point of this recent publication that you're referring to is of just critical importance, and it's something we've been following now for a couple of decades. Certainly the incidence of CTE, based on our research and that of other groups around the country, is thought to be far less than a third of former football players. Certainly there have been studies suggesting higher rates of CTE, but really those studies have been confounded by something we call ascertainment bias, that if you're only studying people with who clearly have some form of brain disease, whether it be Alzheimer's disease or CTE, you're likely to find a very high rate of the disease in that population. But when we look at an all-comers population of NFL players, and we have been conducting a study here at MCW and Fraidert over the last several years looking at long-term outcomes in former NFL players, we find that most players, in fact, are remaining healthy late into life, both cognitively and physically. But there is due to a variety of risk factors and reasons, there seems to be a small percentage of former athletes, not just football players, who are experiencing cognitive decline potentially associated with their history of concussion and repetitive head impact exposure. The challenge we face as scientists and clinicians is determining what those risk factors are and how do we prevent young athletes from being affected by them. The upshot of this recent JAMA paper, however, is that we find that a significant percentage and proportion of former athletes are walking around with concerns that they may have chronic traumatic encephalopathy with or without any real signs and or symptoms of neurodegenerative disease. And the main concern here is that they see a doom and gloom outlook associated with chronic traumatic encephalopathy that they may not even have and elect to make a impulsive decision or walk around with ideation about ending their life to avoid that slippery slope that they are fearing unrealistically. When in fact, the paper really makes the point is that our work and that of groups around the country demonstrates that most of the health concerns that former athletes face are due to modifiable factors. Just the same as you and I, they have to do with our weight, our nutrition, our exercise, our mental health, all things that can be addressed and the health problems associated with those risk factors reversed in order to restore a longer life of health and function.
I want to end with your work on the NFL's Head, Neck, Spine Committee, the neuropsychology consultant at the Green Bay Packers. When you talk about the future of reducing these types of injuries, reducing the blows to the head, what is being done at the committee level for this work?
The landscape has changed dramatically in terms of how we care for athletes affected by concussion at all competitive levels. So there are now international consensus guidelines that dictate the evaluation, management, and return to play after sport-related concussion. Return to play after concussion has gone from 15 minutes to 15 days in about 15 years. And now on average, athletes are withheld from play somewhere in the order of about 12 to 15 days, which allows adequate brain recovery and significantly reduces the risk of repeat concussion, which is where athletes get in the most trouble. There have been numerous policy changes, both within rulemaking in the game and how the game is played itself. This year, most recently, the introduction of the Guardian Cap and changes in the kickoff rules. But there's also been a major change that we don't see on Sundays as to how athletes prepare in practice. So our research finds that about 3/4 of all concussions in football and about 2/3 of all head impact exposure occurs during practice, not in games. So at all competitive levels now, contact is limited over the course of the season. We've done away with two-a-day practices in college. And there have been numerous rule changes and policy changes, all aimed at improving the health and safety of athletes. Again, not within just American football, but across all contact and collision sports. So, you know, I wear this hat as researcher and clinician in the neurosciences, but I'm also a parent. And what I take sort of great consolation in is that contact sports have never been safer than they are now. Certainly relative to when we played, again, 40 years ago when I was younger. But, you know, parents can now have great confidence and faith in if their young athlete is affected by concussion, they're going to get proper care and a very conservative approach to not only returning to play, but decision-making about their son or daughter's fitness to continue participation in sport. None of that thinking was evident 20 to 25 years ago.
So much change. Mike, thank you for the update. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks. It was a real pleasure. I appreciate it.
That was Mike McCray, professor of neurosurgery and neurology at the Medical College of Wisconsin and directs its brain injury research program. He served on the NFL's Head, Neck, and Spine Committee and is a neuropsychology consultant to the major pro sports teams in Wisconsin. As we learn about efforts to reduce head injuries in sports, we find out about advancements in protective gear. A Wisconsin researcher is developing his own protective materials to prevent injuries and concussions. Ramathasan Thevamaran is an associate professor of mechanical engineering at UW-Madison. Theva, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Your lab has developed a new material for helmets to prevent concussions. Can you tell us about the projects you're working on and where it might be useful?
Right. So in my lab at University of Wisconsin-Madison, we work on a material system called vertically aligned carbon nanotubes. So this is a hierarchical material, meaning it will have structural features starting from fewer nanometers all the way up to several millimeter scale. And it gives us a huge design freedom that I can tailor these structural features across all these length scales, going from fewer nanometers, that's like a few tens of atoms, and all the way up to several millimeter scale where we have the helmet padding. Give you an idea that the basic building block over here is a carbon nanotube. So this carbon nanotube is almost 1,000 times smaller than the diameter of the hair. So you can imagine that it's a very tiny, tiny, tiny element. But then when you stack them up, a lot of them together like a forest, they provide you this vertically aligned morphology that we can use as a cushion. And one of the nicest thing about this material system is it's extremely lightweight because it's made up of carbon. And so it can be used in several applications where you would need exceptional properties at lightweight, particularly in the context of sports, you need agility. So in that context, it's very useful. The second advantage is that we have shown through several studies compared to polymeric forms, like the what is used in Guardian cabs, this material behaves in a rate-independent fashion. That means whether you impact at low velocities or high velocities, so compress them very slowly, it behaves exactly the same way. So we would call it strain rate independent behavior. So this material exhibits superior properties over the polymeric materials that are typically used. In addition to that, because this is a carbon-based material, it also gives you very high thermal conductivity and thermal stability. So you can wear the material across different temperature regimes as well.
Oh, so it could have cooling properties.
Absolutely. We have shown through our studies in a laboratory setting that this material provides you much higher effective thermal conductivity and thermal diffusivity, so it can give you cooling properties. Also, the mechanical properties. Vice also, the mechanical properties will be stable whether it's in a cold weather or in an extreme hot desert weathers. So they can find application in various scenarios, not just in sports, but also in the combat and various other, say, skiing and various other applications.
So military ballistic helmets, bulletproof materials, you know, can you talk about some of these different applications?
Absolutely. So in Wisconsin, we have a program called PANTHER program. The PANTHER stands for physics-based neutralization of threats to human tissues and organs. So it's led by one of my colleagues, Professor Christian Frank, and supported by the Office of Naval Research program that is managed by Dr. Tim Bentley. The idea of this program is that we wanted to understand the basics of traumatic brain injury. And then we take that understanding and then we try to design material system that can allow us to prevent potential traumatic brain injuries. And then ultimate goal is to develop pathways that can be used to heal the traumatic brain injury over a time, right? Mm-hmm. So in this particular program, there are lots of different partners, and some of them are also industrial partners. Some applications vary from, as I mentioned, military helmets to protect soldiers during combat. It could be from direct impact, or else, like as you said, ballistic penetration, or else secondary impacts, like you're thrown off due to a blast, and then that can cause an impact. Or else it could be due to the blast wave itself, there will be shock induced to your brain, and we want to reduce such shock events. We now understand most of the traumatic brain injury or the most of the concussive events occur due to shear that we are inducing in the brain during impact. That means when you are hitting something, if your head tends to rotate, that can cause more damage because your brain is made up of a lot of water. So it can take a lot of pressure, but it cannot take much shear. So when you try to shear the brain, that can cause more injury. So the modern bicycle helmets are now coming up ways to accommodate shear. And if you think about the carbon nanotube, for example, this can accommodate large amount of shear and also dissipate kinetic energy during the shear event as well. Yeah. So that's also we find as an advantage on these carbon nanotubes.
Theva, you have filed for patents. What is the next stage of your research and where could the next breakthroughs be in carbon nanotube material?
Right. So over the years, we have been mainly focusing on the fundamental studies as we started the lab here. And then most recently, we started working with our industrial partners, as I said, combat helmet manufacturer, bicycle helmet manufacturers, as well as the ski helmet manufacturers, as well as helmets for construction industry, for example. In those places also, there is potential for injuries. So we're working with these partners. So the next step is for us to test these in real helmet scale and explore the potential in realistic conditions. And once we know that, then our ultimate goal is to get the product to the market where it will have impact on saving lives.
Theva, so many possibilities. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your research.
It has been a real pleasure joining you. Thank you for having me.
That was Ramathasan Thevamaran, an associate professor of mechanical engineering at UW-Madison. And earlier, we talked with Medical College of Wisconsin clinical neuropsychologist Mike McCray as we look at the latest advancements in reducing head injuries and protective headgear.
Coming up, a century-old pipe organ in a Wisconsin church just started playing again after a major overhaul project.
It's been such a blessing for us to have this instrument back in a very high-performing level.
Hear the story behind the historic instrument coming up on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here is producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about a Milwaukee writer who cheers for the home team and their main rival.
The rivalry between Milwaukee Brewers fans and Chicago Cubs fans is heated. And definitely this season after Craig Counsell went from being the Brewers manager to the Cubs manager. But there is such a thing as a Cubs-Brewers fan. Milwaukee freelance journalist Tom Kircher is one of them.
I've always said that when it comes to baseball, I have dual citizenship. In my case, you could spell dual D-U-A-L or D-U-E-L. You see, I'm a fan of the Milwaukee Brewers and the Chicago Cubs. For some baseball fans, that might seem impossible, kind of like the idea of sweet poison or Budweiser Platinum. But you don't give up on your first love, especially when your heart is big enough for two. Here's how I became a Cubs Brewers fan. I grew up near Milwaukee in Cedarburg. Well, the town of Jackson, actually, out in the country. One of our neighbors had three boys around my age. Their aunt and uncle down the street had a huge empty lot next to their house. It seemed like we played baseball there every summer afternoon. This was in the late 1960s when there was no Major League Baseball team in Milwaukee. The Braves had left for Atlanta after the 1965 season, and the Brewers didn't arrive until 1970. On one of the afternoons when we weren't playing baseball, I discovered that the Chicago Cubs were on the radio. A lot. In those days, long before Wrigley Field got lights, the Cubs played all of their home games in the afternoon. I fell in love with that team and the WGN radio announcers, Vince Lloyd and Lou Boudreau.
Vince Lloyd and Lou Boudreau here at Wrigley Field, where some showers have fallen, knocking up some.
How they could stir my imagination.
Taking on the Eastern Division.
I still feel the adrenaline rush when I remember the song that played before every broadcast. I know it by heart. It's a beautiful day for a ball game. For a ball game today. The fans are out to get a ticket or two. From Walla Walla, Washington to Kalamazoo. It's a beautiful day for a home run. But even a triple's okay. We're gonna cheer and boo and raise a hullabaloo at the ball game today. Then came that triumphant voice.
The Chicago Cubs are on the air. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome once again.
Of course, once Major League Baseball came back to Milwaukee, it wasn't hard to become a Brewers fan, too. My dad would take me to games at Old County Stadium.
Here's the 1-2 to Henry. Here's a drive, left field deep. Hey, get out of here for Henry. It is gone.
When the two teams play each other, I really can't lose. I still have on my wall from my childhood a black and white 8x10 of my favorite Cubs player, Hall of Famer Billy Williams. It's next to the front page of the newspaper that I framed from when the Brewers made it to the playoffs in 2008 for the first time in 26 years. Great stuff. I still listen to Cubs games on the radio. That is, when I'm not listening to the Brewers. Sometimes I can listen to one and then the other. Now that's a beautiful day for a ballgame.
Wow! Tom Kircher is a journalist from Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
The Major League Baseball regular season ends this Sunday. The Brewers have clinched the National League Central title. They've qualified for the playoffs for the sixth time in the last seven seasons. The Cubs have been eliminated from the playoffs, which begin on Tuesday. That's the sound of an organ more than 100 years old that's been brought back to life.
The first German Lutheran church in Manitowoc recently held a special service to celebrate their refurbished pipe organ. The instrument was first installed in 1919. Work to fix the organ started in 2022.
What's the story behind this historic instrument and what it means to this congregation? Jacob Huff is pastor at First German Lutheran Church in Manitowoc, and Joel Ungemach is an organist and the chairman of the church's committee in charge of restoring that pipe organ. Joel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us. It's great to be here.
And Pastor Huff, thanks for being with us.
It's a privilege to spend a little time with you today.
Pastor Huff, can you start by telling us a little bit about the story of what I guess is probably the oldest member of your congregation, this pipe organ installed back in 1919? Give us a little of that history.
Yeah, our church, it's 170 years old. The building, we just celebrated its 150th birthday last year in 2023. And the organ was added 105 years ago. So for 105 years, the organ has been filling our church with music and helping the congregation sing praises to God.
Joel, a presentation from your church called this instrument a historic example of early 20th century American organ building. What makes this pipe organ special?
Well, first of all, the beauty of the organ, the way the builders crafted the woodwork, the exposed pipes, it's just beautiful to look at, first of all. And then secondly, the sound of the organ is a classic pipe organ sound. And when we redid it, we wanted to make sure that anything that we added to it or took away from it sustained the historical value of the sound, as well as matched the sound that was there.
Pastor Huff, why was restoring this instrument important to members of your congregation?
Many of the members of our congregation have been worshiping here for generations. Their families have. They've grown up here. They were baptized here, confirmed here. For Sunday after Sunday, they've come here and found a place for community and a place for hope and everything that God offers us in Jesus. And so having an instrument that can support that, the sound of the instrument that was a part of their childhood, a part of their adolescent years, a sound of an instrument that was with them when they were at the funeral of a loved one. It was an instrument that helped them find hope and peace and comfort. And so when it was starting to fall into disrepair, the opportunity to rebuild it and have that for generations to come in the future was something they didn't want to pass up.
Joel, I'm fascinated by pipe organs because with a piano, right, it's all in that box. Everything you see is right there. The pipe organ, though, the keyboard itself, that's just one component. That's the controller for this really huge instrument. Can you just describe how big the organ is and how it takes up space in the church?
Well, we have a sizable balcony where the organ sits. So the fact that it sits up against the back of the church itself and into the bell tower area doesn't really hamper us from gathering as a congregation. And one of the beautiful things about the organ is that it can be used softly to present a soft, quiet message at Christmas time, and it can fill the church with sound, all with one person playing as we celebrate the resurrection at Easter. So the beauty of a pipe organ itself is to be able to speak the many different moods of a Christian congregation worshiping.
Pastor Huff, I've never really thought about this, but while you're making your way through a church service and the different parts, how much do you feel that organ setting the mood, setting the stage for the congregation?
Organ is such a unique instrument. We have a piano too. We use that in worship sometimes. We'll use guitar and violin and different instruments. An organ, it can quietly set the mood, like Joel had mentioned. It also, like, you can feel it in the space. Like when the organist really opens it up and lets the volume ring out and it's a loud song of praise and the congregation is singing, you can actually feel it like vibrating in your body and rattling you to the bones. As hundreds of people sometimes gather together singing praises. It's a really, really fascinating and fun thing to experience.
Joel, what's it like to play an instrument with that much range and that much power?
Early on in my organ playing, it was nerve-wracking, I'll be honest with you, to be able to play for a sizable congregation and lead them in song. But as I've grown in experience, which means that I'm getting older, it's been a pleasure to be able to do that. And it's just a really enriching opportunity to lead the congregation in song.
We're talking about a historic restoration of a 105-year-old pipe organ with Pastor Jacob Huff and Joel Ungemach. They are with the First German Lutheran Church in Manitowoc. You mentioned, Pastor Huff, the refurbishment of the organ. That was part of your celebration of the 150th anniversary of the construction of your church. What is it like for you to be the current steward of an institution with such a deep history?
Steward is a good word for it, right? This church has been here long before I came, and God willing, it'll be here long after I leave. But the same building has been gathering around the same message for 150 years in the same place. That it's just really, it's a humbling thing. I've always appreciated history and being able to step into a pulpit. We have a raised pulpit that's like 14 feet in the air. And to preach a sermon where pastors who served generations before me did the same thing. It's a humbling thing to realize that I get to step into that place and not share something new, but something that has been bringing hope to generations of people, just for today's people. It's been a real joy and a privilege to be a small part of a big history.
And on similar lines, Joel, your hands are not the first to run that keyboard. Your feet aren't the first to control those pedals. How much do you feel the history of that instrument as you play?
It's something that I've embraced in my 20-some years here in Manitowoc. I've happened to know some of the different organists that have played here over the years, and it's a deep, rich history. And it's just an honor to be able to lead this congregation in song. They are very good singing congregation, by the way.
Pastor Huff, this is mainly, of course, for the congregation. Are there or will there be public performances where people can check out the organ's new look and restored sound?
Yeah, well, any given weekend, we have a regular Thursday service at 4:30 in the afternoon and Sunday morning at 9 in the morning. It's on our YouTube, church's YouTube page, First German Lutheran in Manitowoc. You can search it. We had a recital a couple of weekends ago when we had the special dedication. We had a guest organist come and give an organ recital. And we are currently planning still some events throughout the year to show off the organ as we bring it into its new range, new mode, new season of existence.
Pastor Huff, I imagine as you were training to follow your calling as a pastor, you've probably now learned way more about the technical points of organ design than you probably anticipated, I'm guessing.
That's absolutely true. I grew up in a church that had a pipe organ, but it was just that thing that made sound in the back of church. And having been a part of this process, just understanding how big it is and how intricate it is and how just, you know, a handful of dust can throw some pipes out of whack and make them stop playing, and how the leathers that are part of each pipe that allow it to speak when it's supposed to speak, how they can dry up and crack, and all the things that can happen in a pipe organ and everything that makes it make the sound that it does.
And Joel, I play a saxophone that's about 80 years old. When I get a tune-up, I can definitely tell the difference. I can see the improvement. As the guy who plays the organ, do you have a sense that, like, yes, you feel and hear that change?
Oh, definitely. This has been such a big change for us. It handles differently than it did before the restoration. Probably the biggest thing that we've noticed as organists is that we're not having to compensate for all the little things that were going wrong and some very big things that were going wrong over the last few years. So it's been such a blessing for us to have this instrument back in a very high performing level.
We'll leave it there. Joel, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having us. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
And Pastor Huff, thanks a lot for being with us.
It's a privilege. Thanks for having us.
Jacob Huff is pastor at First German Lutheran Church in Manitowoc, and Joel Ungemach is an organist, the chairman of the church's committee to restore their historic pipe organ.
And you can head over to WPR.org to see a picture of the 105-year-old pipe organ, and you can listen to the organ's dedication service that was held earlier this month.
Hey, if you are someone who restores and repairs instruments, or you've taken your instrument to a repair shop for an overhaul, love to hear your story. You can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Maybe you send a picture of an instrument that you play or that you've worked on. Kate, have you ever run in a marathon?
Nope, not by a long shot.
Is it on your to-do list? I'm never gonna. I never have.
No, it's not
too much.
Too much.
Okay, so I think we're both probably impressed by people who've completed one marathon. But how about somebody who's completed 2,000 marathons? marathons. Next week, we're going to meet a runner from Hobart who's looking to complete number 2000 this weekend.
Wow. And we want to hear from you. Have you ever run a marathon, or maybe lots and lots of them? Do you have goals that you're trying to hit? Maybe it's a time or one in each state or other goals. Let us know about it.
Call or text at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. You can also email us. WisconsinToday@WPR.org is the address. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/WisconsinToday. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.